Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit.
Welcome, everyone, to the GeoMob Podcast. Today is a bit of a special episode. Our topic was suggested by a listener to the show. If you have an interview that you want to hear about or one that you want to give, then get in touch with the podcast and we'll try to make that happen. So we're going to be talking about lost ponds today. How do we find them again and why does that matter? So let's get straight into the discussion and find out more. Hi there, Darren.
Hi, good to be here.
Thanks for coming on the show. Can we start with you introducing yourself and who you work for?
Yeah, I'm Darren Tansley and I work at Essex Wildlife Trust. So I'm the Wilder Rivers and Protected Species Manager. Now, that may not sound particularly related to ponds, but I work with a wide range of landowners, mainly farm clusters, various other landowners, at a landscape scale. And ponds are a vital source of water in the environment, so that's where I'm coming from.
That's cool. So do you do a lot of geospatial stuff, or are you mainly approaching it from an ecological side?
So
what's your background?
I mean, I really am a practitioner, so I'm delivering projects on the ground. But obviously, as you can imagine, more and more we're looking at evidence base for our ecological work, and that involves a good degree of mapping. So we use ArcGIS mainly as our mapping tool at Essex Wildlife Trust. And I have access to the light version. I'm not trusted with the full version. but I can use that to my advantage when I'm out in the field mapping from a tablet. It's usually ecological data. So normally I'd be mapping, say, the distribution of water voles or otters or something like that, and plugging that into a sort of ready-made template on where do we get that? That just sort of downloads straight to our servers from the tablet, right, which is useful for me. There's no double errors then, you know, of writing it down, going into the office, retyping it and getting a grid reference wrong.
Yeah, done that in the past.
Yeah, it's just a nightmare. You find that you've got a water vole out in the middle of the North Sea and you think, oh, I can't
Yes, definitely. So I guess the big question is, why should our listeners care about ponds?
Yeah, I mean, ponds do seem to be a sort of neglected resource, and yet they have incredible value in the countryside. So we're looking at species like turtle doves, for instance. That's why we've worked with the RSPB on this particular project. They need water within a few hundred metres of their nest site for the young. So they've got to have both that habitat, the scrubby habitat for them to nest into, but also to have that water supply close to hand. So that's one example of a species that absolutely must have water near where it lives. But they are stepping stones for a lot of different species. As you can imagine, we're getting very volatile ecological times now with our weather patterns. We have very long periods of dry weather followed by extremely wet weather, and that continuity of water in the landscape is vital for a wide range of mammals, birds, but also insect life. And we're getting very interested in the insects that are in these ponds because they're the food source for most of those birds that are breeding. So if you don't have the insects, you don't have the birds. And as you can imagine, in a farmed landscape, a lot of that is arable crop that's sprayed so that insects, you know, that they don't get into it. So you've got to have these little oases of life, really.
Right. Oh, cool. And so what sort of sizes are we talking about in terms of ponds? And are they always full of water, or are they ephemeral?
Some will just dry up every year, so they'll be there after the winter, and they might carry on until about June, and then they dry out. They're still valuable because a lot of our amphibians breed in spring, but they have a largely terrestrial lifestyle, so they're out and about across the landscape. You know, people think frogs and newts live in ponds. Well, they breed in ponds, but they don't necessarily live there. They'll probably spend more of their life actually out in the countryside hunting for food. So, yeah, they're really a real mix. You've got some that are permanent. They might be quite large, you know, sort of 200 or 300 meters long, something like that. And other little ones are just, you know, 10 meters across, and they're just sitting there doing their thing in the corner of a field.
Cool. So have the wildlife trusts been mapping them in the past, sort of in the field, mapping them manually? And is this sort of Lost Ponds project trying to do something, trying to scale it up, something that's happened sort of from surveyors going out in the field in the past? Or is this project trying to do something completely different from what's happened in the past?
Yeah, I think we have approached it from a different angle this time. So okay. We were inspired by the Norfolk Ponds project. Dr. Carl Sayer has been restoring these, what are known as ghost ponds. They're the ponds that have been infilled and have disappeared completely. There's nothing on the ground. You can't see them anymore, but you can perhaps see a difference in the vegetation that grows there. It might be a bit more lush than you would expect for the rest of a field or something. So we looked at what he was doing and thought ghost ponds would be a good thing to restore. Mm-hmm. They have a seed bank that's still sitting in the silt underneath the field or whatever is on top of them. And when you dig that out and water gets into the pond, all these seeds start to germinate. And you can have species coming back that have been extinct in a county for 150 years. And then suddenly they appear seemingly from nowhere, but they've been sitting there dormant for all those decades waiting for water to arrive. So that was the inspiration. But what we wanted to do was scale this up to find out what we had actually lost in Essex. And so we started a citizen science project for this. We got a group of our, well, they're basically river surveyors, but they're interested in everything. And we asked them to basically take a 10 by 10 kilometre square each and go onto the Scottish National Library's website and bring up an OS map from the 1800s and an aerial photograph that's current. And then you can swipe backwards and forwards and you can compare the two and you can see where the historic ponds were, map those out so everyone was grid referenced from the OS maps.
Okay.
And then compare it to that photograph and see what's there now. And that gave us three categories of ponds. Ones that were completely lost, the ghost ponds. Ones that were so overgrown you couldn't see them, so potentially they were either dry or just useless. Those are the zombie ponds. You know, they're still there, but they're not doing anything. They're undead ponds. And then we had the ponds that you could see that were still there and were obviously full of water and still in the landscape. And that project took about 3 months to map with our citizen scientists. And we mapped 17,200 ponds from the 1800s. Whoa. Only 3,500 were still in the landscape in good condition. Another 3,500 were still there, but zombies, and the rest had gone completely. So we looked at basically an 80% reduction in our ponds over that century, and 60% of them were gone completely.
And so would the majority of those disappear due to sort of land use changes, agricultural changes?
Yeah, exactly that. Some of them are under building and car parks and, you know, housing estates, but the majority were filled in. So they were deliberately removed, and mostly post-war, when field sizes started to become larger to accommodate the machinery instead of a horse and plough. You needed to be able to have big turning circles, and also it made it more efficient for that machinery to roll over a huge field rather than five or six small ones. So at that stage, all the hedgerows were being ripped out. The ponds that would have probably mostly lined along those hedgerows and used for livestock and horses were no longer of any use, so they were infilled. And in fact, in some instances, the hedgerows that were being ripped out were being put into the ponds to infill them just to get rid of the debris. So the majority of those ponds went at that stage. They were just taken out of the landscape. But it was a process that went largely unnoticed.
Yeah.
Nobody thought about it until we started mapping it. Now, that map of the 17,000 ponds and all of the lost ponds, I mean, when you see the map of 10,000 lost ponds, you see the scale of the issue.
Yeah.
Is a great tool for us, because we can show that to the public, and they just look at it and think, oh my goodness, what have we done to our landscape? It's not necessarily the finish point, because that map is really more of a tool rather than something that we would use on the ground, because we can't really tell just from an aerial photograph what's actually happening. We have to go out there and ground truth it.
Right. Okay. Those some of those numbers are absolutely stunning. I must admit.
I know it's depressing as well at times. Yeah. Scale of loss that we've had that nobody really noticed.
Yeah. I've recently been taking a little bit. So my background is in earth observation for land cover change, and I've recently been. And so, like, most of my career has been looking at land cover change within a 10-year period from whenever I'm sort of studying something, all in the last sort of 25, 30 years or so. And I suddenly realized that I had this naivety as to what the longer term land cover changes were. So I've been reading up a little bit, and it's just absolutely gobsmacking reading some descriptions that I've seen about what the countryside was like in the sort of 1750s, and then how the Enclosures Act totally changed that, and then how there was mass deforestation because of the Napoleonic Wars and they needed wood for ships, and then again during the First and Second World Wars, like, orchards were totally scrubbed up and to make room for sort of crops that would feed the nation, etc. And yeah, it is fascinating how we lose all of these habitats and sort of land uses and land cover types. And it just happens, and no one seems to necessarily be aware of it at the time. But then when you start to look back in projects like this, you really see the impact that's made. It's
gives you a perspective that you wouldn't otherwise have. And that's the beauty of a map, is that it demonstrates something that you can't see when you're just walking around the countryside. You get that overview and perspective that you wouldn't otherwise have. And likewise, the resurgence of using aerial photographs through drone, drone technology now helps us at the Trust. We have a drone pilot on our mapping and data team. And she can do extraordinary things on, say, the salt marshes, so that we can see what the patterns of degradation are there. But with the ponds, I think it took us all by surprise, just how many had gone. And that is then a great tool to go to farmers and say, look, we've lost a lot of this, but we could be restoring it. And a lot of these zombie ponds are just sitting in corners of fields. They're not used for anything, they're not cropped, and so for a farmer to be able to put that back and feel that sort of sense of satisfaction that they're helping the environment, and it's not having any knock-on effect for them, and we can point them in the direction of funding as well when we go out and do our surveys of their farms, that's a great feeling, to be working directly in partnership with the food producers, who have to, they have to crop their fields, but they can do other stuff that's going to be, of benefit to the wider environment. And they're all really keen to take part.
Yeah, no, that's cool. Just out of interest, have you been able to look at the maps and see, here we might have a cluster of, say, 10 ponds that could all be looked at in terms of regenerating them, and is that a thing that you're interested in, or are you going sort of landowner by landowner rather than clusters of ponds for creating, maybe nature reserves and that sort of thing?
Well, to be perfectly honest, we're targeting areas that already have groups of farmers that work together in these farm clusters, because it's easier for us to talk to one person at the cluster who can then disseminate all the information to their members. Yeah. And each farm cluster might cover around about 50,000 hectares. You've got a very large chunk of landscape then to work on. And of course, our resources are limited. So what we did was we worked with the North Essex Farm Cluster to train up our volunteers, and they went out across a farm and learned how to survey ponds, and now they go out and they give free surveys to farmers and point them in the direction of which ponds need restoring and which don't. So we tend to work on a farm level at the moment. So we go out to a farm and we might survey 50 ponds in 2 days with our volunteers, and then the report tells you which ones are good, which ones are bad, and which ones, you know, just don't do anything with them.
So are there any lessons that you learned regarding the mapping process for pulling out those ponds? And is there anything you'd change if you were going to do it again?
I think we certainly were surprised at how quickly our volunteers really got on top of this mapping, and they really enjoyed it, and they were asking for more places to map. So I think that worked really well.
Yeah.
It gives people the understanding that they're part of a project that's actually going to deliver on the ground, because ponds are now being restored. So it's actually had an impact on the real world. And I think that following it through from, you know, your screen to a pond, actually a living pond with dragonflies across it and, you know, turtle doves arriving and maybe waterfalls or something like that, gives you that real sense of satisfaction as a volunteer citizen scientist that you're having an impact on, you know, real world ecology.
Yeah, I think you're right. That really does make a difference. There's a tiny little reserve near where I live, and I know that someone's been going out and doing DNA, trying to see sort of whether or not there's great crested newts, I think, in there, and whether or not there's water voles, because we know that there's water voles in the next valley, but no one's recorded them in this valley. And yeah, I think being able to get the local population involved is a really helpful way, even if it's the people who are already interested in ecology and mapping and stuff like that. It really helps.
Yeah, and for those volunteers to meet farmers and find out that actually many of them really do care about their environment, and they're looking to join schemes like this and get things done. So, you know, farmers can get bashed a bit for, you know, the amount of land that they, you know, they're spraying and all of these sorts of things. But actually many of them now are just trying to negotiate the strange systems that the government puts in that change every 5 minutes, and try to do something good on their land. And that's been a real positive for all of us, I think, to work together.
Yeah. So just flipping back to some of the geospatial stuff that you were mentioning earlier in terms of going out in the field with a tablet with maps on, do you also interact with the farmers and show them the maps and the drone data that you have and talk them through what you're seeing from an ecological perspective and how that might help on their specific piece of land?
Yeah, because we will go down to a much finer detail level of mapping once we go onto a farm. So we'll bring up, you know, sort of very high resolution maps of their farm. We might even ask them if they know what ponds they've got, because you'd think that they'd know where all the ponds are.
Yeah,
they probably know most of them, but they don't realize where the ghost ponds are or some of the ones that have, you know, just deteriorated a long time ago. So it's quite interesting to get that local knowledge plus the maps, the detailed maps. And then, of course, it is literally just walking the fields. It's going out there and checking every single location, seeing what, you know, the actual pond looks like from the ground rather than from an aerial photograph, which might be 10 years out of date. So,
of course,
that's the important thing, is that next level of mapping. So that's really a fine detail brush, if you like, whereas the initial mapping that we did was very much to just get that initial shock and awe about the situation and be able to actually present something that people could understand at a county level.
Yeah.
I would imagine that any county that we mapped would be in a similar situation to Essex. We're not unique in this situation.
That was going to be my next question, actually, is are you aware of other wildlife trusts in other counties looking to do this, or are you talking to them, trying to encourage them to do this?
Yeah, when we've had the publicity initially through The Guardian, but then through the BBC and various other news outlets, we were contacted by a number of different counties to say, "What? Well, how did you do this? You know, how much did that cost?" And it, you know, actually very little, as long as you've got a little bit of staff time to coordinate and you've got a good batch of volunteers, which all wildlife trusts do. We cannot actually work without volunteers. They are the lifeblood of the whole movement. So, yes, it was quite interesting to have those conversations. But say, we can't claim credit for this. You know, it was Carl Sayer's work originally in Norfolk that really gave us the impetus to get on with it. And he is such an awe-inspiring ecologist. What he doesn't know about ponds, honestly, you could write on the back of a postage stamp. I mean,
right.
It's phenomenal going out with him and seeing his passion for that environment. Which was something that I've got to admit, I was so hooked up on my river work, I just didn't give ponds a second thought. Yeah. And now, you know, half my life is spent thinking about ponds.
I guess, yeah, the fact that the data is openly available and you have volunteers giving up their time, that really, you're right, that takes out a large concern, which is the whole sort of cost of things. So it's and the amount of interest that there would be for people understanding what's happening in their locality in terms of lost habitats and in particular lost ponds. I mean, that's huge. So
really is that all counties now producing local nature recovery strategies. So they are usually run by the county councils, and our mapping has been used to actually highlight lost ponds, and that is now a key thing in the local nature recovery strategy. And that all came through while we were desperately trying to get the maps done in time for the publication of this strategy.
Right.
But it's in there, and again, for your volunteers to know that their work has gone into an important strategy for ecology, again, is a wonderful thing to have there.
So if there were people listening who, I don't know, maybe they volunteer for a trust that's nowhere near Essex and they wanted to do this sort of thing, is the methodology listed somewhere on your website, or would they get in touch with you, or how would people start to do this for their county?
They could definitely get in touch with me or my counterpart, Mark Norris at RSPB. We've got the methodology, so it's easily replicable by anybody with a laptop and a browser. So there's nothing arcane or, you know, particularly difficult about this. It's just a bit of, you know, work on your laptop. So you could just map out your local parish and see what you had and what you haven't got. You know, that would be of interest to anybody. I'm sure parish council might like to know that sort of information and work with their landowners. So yes, it's perfectly possible for anybody to actually start this. It's then the case of getting out there and meeting the landowners and seeing which ponds they'd like to restore and which ones they wouldn't. Because I can tell you it would be a hard sell to get somebody to resurrect a ghost pond right in the middle of a wheat field and have to drive the tractor around it every time. So, you know, you go for the easy wins to start with, but there are many of those.
No, that's brilliant. That's been absolutely amazing just talking to you about this, and I'm really heartened that sort of geospatial mapping data has been able to help in identifying where these things are and how then it can feed into what needs to be done in order to get them up and running. I was just wondering, is there anything else that you'd like to add that maybe I haven't touched upon about the project?
Well, I think now we've started working on it, and you know, there've been 80 ponds restored, and there's more on their way. We've started to look at the other value of ponds in the landscape, and of course, these insects that breed in those ponds. Some of those are very beneficial to farmers because they'll they're predators. You know, beetles are predators of exactly the insects that the farmers are spraying off in their fields. So our next step really is to map the penetration of these insects out into the fields themselves and see whether there's an actual economic benefit to farmers having ponds in their fields. And that would be really exciting, because that would then allow farmers to think, right, restoring ponds is not only good for the environment, but it's good for farming as well. I don't have to use as many pesticides because these insects will be roaming around my fields and controlling the pests that I don't want in there. So there are always spin-offs from these projects, and that's something that, yeah, we will be looking into hopefully in the next 2 or 3 years with the University of Central London.
Yeah, that's been brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast and talking about it. And I really wish you all the best in terms of getting as many of these ponds restored as possible. So thank you, Dan.
Thank you to you for not interrogating me too much on the detail of the map, which, I've got the vaguest of grasp on, but it certainly works for us.
Well, that's the thing. If it works, it works. So that's great. Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMob podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn, so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. We hope to see you at an event soon.